I'd like to paint a scenario for you that I find somewhat fanciful, but to be honest, many believe to be accurate. Men and women, young people, even children, all decide on one day that they are going to climb up a mountain, the same mountain. Now, what's so interesting about this scenario is that each person is going to choose their own path to get up that mountain. But they are all going up the same mountain, just choosing the path that seems best for them. And sure enough, every single last person gets to the top of the mountain. And when they get to the top of the mountain, they all find who they were looking for. They find God. That, my friends, is today's preferred religion. There's a term for it. It's called pluralism. And basically what that means is that there are many paths to God. But all of us are headed in the same direction towards God, even though we are all choosing our own path. All I know in our culture is, please do not say there is just one path to the top of that mountain. Pluralism says there are many paths. We're all headed in the same direction. And to be honest with you, that particular mindset is attractive in our culture because of the narrative that we read. It's attractive for several reasons. First of all, saying that there are multiple ways to get to God, and please do not say there's only one way to God, fits our desire for peace. Let's be honest. Think of how much violence has been perpetuated down through the centuries in the name of religion. So if we were to just eliminate the exclusive claims that religion makes, that there's only one path to God, that sure seems much more viable. But it's also attractive because saying there are multiple paths to God and not just one way seems to fit our distorted understanding of tolerance. The new God, it seems, in our politically correct world is tolerance. And tolerance means that you not only accept me for who I am and what I believe, you do not call into question who I am and what I believe, because that's intolerant, and you don't push your particular exclusive claim on me because that's offensive. And so it seems more attractive to hold to an idea that there are multiple ways to God. But saying there are multiple ways to God and there is not just one way to God also fits our desire to remove all arrogance, especially in terms of religion. It sounds like this: who are you to tell me? Who are you to think that you have a corner on the truth? It seems more humble to say, no one has a corner on the truth. It levels the religious playing field, if you will, to say there are multiple ways to God. But also saying that there are multiple ways to God and that there is not just one way to God fits our definition in our culture of truth. To our society, truth is not absolute. It's relative. It might sound something like this: I have found this to be true for me. Or let everyone find the path that is best for them. Unfortunately, you'll even hear some Christians say things like this: Jesus works for me. leaving the door open that there are some other viable options up that mountain. But I need you to know that there are some problems with the idea of saying there are multiple ways to God, multiple paths. One is, it trivializes the exclusive claims that the major religions of the world all make. One study says this: there are 2.2 billion Christians in the world, 31% of the world, 1.6 billion Muslims, 1.1 billion agnostics or secularists or atheists, all in one basket, and 1 billion Hindus. My dear friends, that is 86% of the world's population who fall into those four buckets, all of them having particular and peculiar ideas about the path up that mountain and who is at the top of that mountain. And to say there are multiple paths to God really trivializes the exclusive claims that these religions all make. For example, the idea of there being one path or multiple paths, which one is it? The Hindu, even though their religion is perhaps the most complex of those four that I've mentioned, still believe that the path up that mountain is what they call the Eightfold Path. The Muslim would say the path up that mountain is to obey Allah sufficiently, meaning that your good outweighs your bad. The secularist or the atheist would say to get up that mountain, if there even is a mountain, is to basically live your life as you please. And the Christian would say there's only one path up that mountain, and it's through Jesus Christ and what he did for you on the cross. So please do not say for 87% of the world's population that there aren't some exclusive claims about the path that you must take up that mountain. And the God on the top of the mountain, it's not the same God for those four groups that I've mentioned. The secularist, there's no God at the top. And even if there is a God at the top, you can't know there is. To the Hindu, there is one God at the top, but you can't know him. To the Christian, there's one God at the top of the mountain, and you can know him through his son. To the Muslim, Allah is at the top. And to the Muslim, it is blasphemous to consider Allah having a son. So there is a problem because all of these religions have and make exclusive claims. And to say that the only way we can have peace is to trivialize those differences and say they don't exist. No, the only way you can have peace is to have respect for people who last week have been created in God's image. But there's a second problem with this. In saying there are multiple paths to God, it's this: absolute truth, exclusive claims, they do exist. To say, listen, to say there is no such thing as absolute truth is in fact a statement of absolute truth. How do you know there's no such thing as absolute truth? The only way you would know there's no such thing as absolute truth is if you knew everything there is to know. You're omniscient. Because it is entirely possible that absolute truth exists outside of the realm of your knowledge. Absolute truth exists in every other part of life, and we know it does. Why would it not exist in the spiritual and the moral part of our being? Tell the policeman that in your world, there's no such thing as absolute truth, and that's why you were going 65 in a 30, and see how he responds to your claim of truth. Tell your doctor that in your world, you are going to refuse to take your medicine and change your diet. Because in your world, a blood pressure reading of 240 over 150 is not a medical issue. And how about math? I used to teach high school math. I'll make it easy for you, okay? Because I know you get bummed out on math. Here's the simple problem. 5 plus 4 equals blank. Let me tell you something. If you put down any other answer than 9, I'm marking it wrong every single time. If you write down 7 or 8 or Y or smiley face or whatever you identify with today, it's wrong. Here's what you understand in terms of absolute truth. Truth is intolerant of error. I'm going to be intolerant of 7 or 8 or smiley face because absolute truth does exist. And we all know there is absolute truth and there are exclusive claims. And the reason we know that is because that is what causes us to be outraged over what we know to be evil and wrong. You cannot get outraged over what someone else does if all truth is what works for you. Becoming morally outraged is what tells us there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong. Let me ask you, does anyone want to live in a world where a man can kill 49 people in a nightclub and injure many more because that's his definition of truth? Of course not. And a more important question, is that the kind of world we do live in? Or do we live in a world where certain things like murder and adultery and lying and stealing are wrong and they are always wrong, mainly because there is a God at the top of the mountain who has said that murder and adultery and lying and stealing are always wrong? Let's be honest. Saying that truth is relative and not absolute is really a mask for saying we do not want to be accountable to the God who is at the top of the mountain. I didn't say that. The psalmist did. He writes these words. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now, why would someone make such a statement? It is because they are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. We would rather say in our culture that God and absolute truth do not exist, and therefore we must make truth up for what it is for us, than to be accountable to Him for what we do with that truth. But there's a third problem with saying that absolute truth and exclusive claims, they do not exist. It assumes that the one God at the top of the mountain has not spoken into this issue, because he has. Someone has written these words. To make the apparently humble and mediating claim that all ways of worshiping the divine are equally valid, you're implicitly making the bold claim to know that God hasn't spoken on these things and doesn't care. How would you know that? Or maybe it's that he's spoken to you, think of the arrogance of that, and declared that all the other religions who claim he does care, because he's made absolute statements, like Christianity and Judaism and Islam and so on, are confused on that point. You see, we believe that God has spoken into this issue about the path up that mountain and who is at the top of that mountain. Christianity speaks into this arena. And in this worldview series, Pastor Jerry has already laid the foundation for what we are going to teach about this morning. One God among many. And if you have not gotten that, you need to go back and watch that series, because I'm going to assume that many of you, if not most of you, have at least had this foundation. Here, I'm going to shape what he has said so that it fits where I'm going. Here's the first statement. There is one God at the top of the mountain. There is only one God at the top of the mountain. This is what he has stated so far. Here's the second thing. That God at the top of the mountain is the God that is revealed in the Bible. This is the foundation. Here's the third statement. Jesus Christ makes an exclusive claim about the path up that mountain. Jesus Christ makes an exclusive claim about the path up that mountain. That is why it was so important for me to lay the foundation for the idea that there is such a thing as absolute truth and exclusive claims, because Jesus makes an exclusive claim about the path up that mountain. You probably know where I'm going. You probably know what scripture I'm going to refer to. Jesus made this statement in John 14, 6. He said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." By placing the definite article before each of those three things, the way, truth, and life, he is making an exclusive claim. I am the one and only way. I am the one and only truth. I am the one and only life. And no one can come to the Father except through me. You see, he's making two exclusive claims here. I am the only way to God, and no one can come to God but through me. There's only one God at the top of the mountain, the God of the Bible. And I am the only path that will take you there. Now, I want to ask you a question. What kind of statement is that? Suppose I said to you, there is only one viable way to get off this platform. Well, if you can do any kind of visual right now, you can see that there are at least seven different ways. There are two staircases here, one over there, one over there. There's a door there. There's a way back there. There's a way back there. I could jump off, but I won't, because you won't catch me. There are seven viable ways to get off this platform. Is that what Jesus meant? That he is a way to God? Or maybe he meant that he is the preferred way, so that when I am done with this message, I might prefer to go through that door. Well, when Pastor Jerry is done, he might prefer a different way. And Pastor Jonathan, he might prefer a different way. And Pastor Wes, he might prefer a different way. Or is that what Jesus meant? That Jesus is the preferred way up the mountain? Or maybe I could say that door right there is the best door to get off this platform. And Pastor Jerry might say, well, I don't really think it is. And so I might have to or try to prove that that's the best way to get off the platform. Is that what Jesus meant? That there's one way to God and I'm the best way? Or there's another thing I could do. I could begin to block all of the other ways off this mountain, off this platform, so that there really is only one way off this platform, and it's through those doors. Is that what Jesus meant? Jesus does not say, I am a way, I am the preferred way, I am the best way. He said, I am the only way. He's making an exclusive claim. And when you make an exclusive claim, there's only two options. It is either true or it is false. Sometimes I hate coming up here and reminding you of your school days, because maybe you want to forget them. But I'll take you back, if you went to college, to your first year of philosophy class. Because in that class, you learn something called the law of contradiction. Now, it's not heavy. It's going to be easy for you to remember and easy for you to think this through. The law of contradiction says two contradicting statements cannot be both true in the same sense at the same time. So if I take two statements, and whatever terms I use in both sentences, I use them with the same definition, they cannot be true at the same time. This is why it says A is B and A is not B. Does your head hurt already? Say amen. Let me give you a real simple problem that fits right in this with A is B and A is not B. Here it is. The sky is blue and the sky is not blue. That's simple. Now, if I'm using the same definition for sky in both sentences, and I'm using the same definition for blue in both sentences, then the sky is blue and the sky is not blue cannot be true at the same time in the same sense. Got it? Help me here. Thank you. I appreciate that. Makes it easy. Also makes it shorter, by the way, when you participate, all right? So, here's the statement that Jesus makes. Here's the statement that Jesus makes. I am the only way to God. You negate that. A is not B. I am not the only way to God. Here's the deal. Both of those statements cannot be true. One of them is true and one of them is false, but they cannot be true at the same time. To say that they're both true is philosophically absurd. The law of contradiction. Therefore, I can say this. The claim that Jesus makes to be the only way to God, he is either the only way to God or he's not. You cannot deny what he has said. He said he was the only way to God. What you can say is, I choose not to accept it. But you cannot deny what he said or that he said that. What I'm left with then, what you're left with what every single person who has ever lived is left with, is this. Whether or not I am going to hang the eternal destiny of my soul on his claim to be the only path up that mountain to that one true God. Let me tell you this morning why I think you should. And I am appealing to you. I'm not preaching at you. I'm not shoving this down your throat. I am appealing to you on the basis of your intellectual integrity. And that means that you are going to, with an open mind, consider the claims of Christ, whether they are true or false. So he makes the claim that he is the only way to God, and that is either true or false. Let me tell you why I think you should rest your eternal destiny on that claim. Because people make claims all the time. Muhammad Ali, who just passed away a few weeks ago, made the claim that he was the greatest boxer of all time. Some, most, maybe all would agree with that statement. But he also had an incredible ability to back it up, didn't he? So Jesus is making an incredible claim here. I am the only path up that mountain. I am the only way to God. You cannot get to God except through me. How did he back it up? Well, here's one. He made claims that only God could make. He made claims that only God could make. Again, asking you to have the intellectual integrity to look at the data with an open mind. Jesus said things, listen, Jesus said things so outrageous that he was either plumb crazy or he's God. For example, he claimed that he existed before his human birth. He claimed that he existed before his human birth. He's not talking about incarnation. He's talking about pre-existence. What other human being has ever made that kind of claim? In John 8, Jesus is having a discussion with the Pharisees, and it goes something like this. If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. He's making an exclusive claim here. I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you, but I do know him and obey his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. Wait a minute. You don't even look like you're 50 years old. And you've seen Abraham? Very truly, I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. But look at that statement, before Abraham was, I am. Now, I don't think that he's just using poor grammar. He's making a statement here. He is saying that he, born in what we would call the first century, pre-existed Abraham, who was born 22 and a half centuries before. Who says that kind of thing? John the Baptist spoke of Jesus. And you just have to let this statement rest on you. Because if it's not God, if he's not God, then it is a most ludicrous statement. He says this in John 1. This is the one I meant. He's talking about Jesus. When I said, a man, listen carefully, who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. The one who comes after me was before me. Now, I was born on my brother Dave's first birthday. That was the best birthday present he ever got. Just that way it was. Now, for my brother to say something like this, Dion, he comes after me, but he's preferred because he was before me. That's not possible. I was born 1 year, exactly 1 year after him. How in the world can you say I was before him? You can't. It's a stupid, ludicrous statement unless he's God and he preexisted. Secondly, here's another claim that he made, that he was sinless. Now, some world religions believe that their leader attained to perfection, but no leader of a world religion ever claimed to be sinless. And so here is Jesus standing before, same conversation, same chapter, John chapter 8, standing before some people, and he asks a question, not to his adoring fans, not to his loyal disciples, but to the cruelest of enemies. He says this, "Which of you can prove me guilty of sin?" Could anyone possibly say the same thing with a straight face? I'll do it. Okay? And class participation here. You raise your hand, especially those of you who would call me your friend. Maybe there's one in here. I don't know. Raise your hand when I say this, all right? Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? Go. That didn't take long. Who makes this kind of statement? Let me tell you something. I'm being just as honest as I possibly can. Here is a issue that I think is a very difficult one. In fact, a stumbling block for critics and skeptics. The purity of Jesus. How can you look into the eyes of Jesus and see absolutely no sin? He claimed to be sinless. There's a third thing. He claimed that he was God. He claimed that he was God. Same context, same chapter, same conversation we've just looked at. He makes this statement in John 8:58. Before Abraham was born, I am. It's not just bad grammar. For me to say, I would say, before Abraham was, I was. But he says, before Abraham was, I am. What's he doing there? What he's doing there is claiming to be the God who appeared to Moses at the burning bush. You remember when Moses asked, "Who shall I say has sent me to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh and to the Israelites?" And God said, "Tell them, I am has sent you." You have to realize the culture in which Jesus is making this statement to be the exact same person. Here is a culture that would not pronounce the name that I just said because they feared mispronouncing it. This is a culture in which every single Jewish male would wake up in the morning, face the temple in Jerusalem, and say these words, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." And here is a 33-and-a-half-year-old man claiming to be the God at the burning bush. They knew exactly what he was saying. That's why they picked up stones to stone him. You don't stone a crazy person, you lock them up. You stone someone who, in their mind, was guilty of blasphemy. So Jesus, I believe we can place our trust in him because he made claims that only God could make. But secondly, he did things that only God could do. He did things that only God could do. Think about this. If the God at the top of the mountain showed up in the world in which he created, what would you expect? Wouldn't you not expect something like this? Only God can take 5 loaves of bread, give one away, and have 6 and not 4. Only God can calm a storm. Only God can walk on water. Only God can give sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. Only God can know what people are thinking. Only God can forgive sin. Only God can raise the dead. So the reason why I believe in the claim of Jesus to be the only way to God is because he said things that only God could say, and he did things that only God could do, but he also, thirdly, He rose from the dead. He rose from the dead. Now, what's interesting to me is that God will never leave himself without a witness. And so at least twice during the earthly ministry of Jesus, religious leaders came up to him and asked him to validate, give them a sign that would validate his authority, that he had been sent from God. And you'll notice a parallel between both statements, one in Matthew and one in John. First in Matthew. Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." He answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asked for a sign, but none will be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." And then in John chapter 2, the Jews then responded to him, "What sign do you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" He had just thrown out the temple. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." So he says, there is one sign that will validate that I am exactly who I said I am. It's this: I will get up out of the grave. He also gives the timing, and I'll do it in 3 days. That is what separates Christianity. In our culture, we want to say there really aren't that many differences between the religions of the world. Here's one. Of all of the world religious leaders, only one got up out of the grave. Only one got up out of the grave. Gary Habermas, he was actually a professor of mine when I was in seminary. He is considered an expert in the area of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he says, if you take the resurrection of Jesus Christ and you use the same criteria for evaluating that as a historical event that you would use to evaluate any other historical events, he says this: there is more evidence that Jesus Christ rose from the dead than there is evidence that George Washington was president of the United States. This is what separates Christianity, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so in saying this, again, the intellectual integrity, the open mind, let me ask you two questions. Here's the first. If Jesus is not who he says he is, then who is he? If Jesus is not who he says he is, then who is he? The greatest question that has to be asked and answered is this: what do you think of the Christ? If he is not who he says he is, then who is he? Now, please do not say that he was a great moral teacher. Let me tell you why. Great moral teachers do not lie about their identity. He said he was God. If he is not God, then he is not a great moral teacher, because he has lied about his identity. No one has ever said this better than C.S. Lewis. I'm trying here to prevent people from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, that I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I do not accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. Shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great moral teacher. He has not left that option open to us. He did not intend to. And so he makes a claim: I am the only way to God. And that is either true or false. If it is false, then dismiss him and do something else with your life. If it is true, then you are faced, I am faced with two options: to either believe or reject. But if it is true, there is no third option. He is either the way or he is no way. Now, I said there were two questions. The first, if Jesus is not who he says he is, then who is he? Here's the second. If Jesus is who he says he is, then who should we be? Who should we be? The people who have claimed to embrace Christ. Who should we be? I want you to know my heart. I did not come here to declare a message so that you would have a stack of arguments to shove down someone's throat. The world does not need arrogant Christians. I did not give you this message so that you would become conceited, but so that you would become convinced. But you need to understand something. We are not going to win the world over through an argument. We're going to win the world over with a changed life. And that humility says something incredible happens. If Jesus is exactly who he says he is, then he is the supernatural Son of God. And Paul says something very interesting to how that applies to you in Colossians 1:27. He says, to them God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. If Jesus Christ is who he says he is, then he is the supernatural Son of God, and he lives inside of you. Would that not speak to an incredible life change? I'll let the Holy Spirit take your mind down whatever path he chooses. I can think of the fruit of the Spirit. If Jesus Christ is the supernatural Son of God and he resides in me, then the world doesn't need to hear an argument. They need to see someone who loves in a world of hate, who has joy in a world of sorrow, who has peace in a world of conflict, who has long-suffering in a world of incredible impatience and intolerance, who is good in a world gone wrong, who is gentle in this harsh, sarcastic, pummel everybody into the ground on Facebook world, who has self-control in a world where everyone has lost control. You see, I believe this. If Jesus is who he says he is, then we should be people who let the supernatural Jesus reveal himself through our lives. That's what I believe. You see, again, the world's not going to be won over by an argument. They'll be won over by this. Something in you that they can't explain as a direct result of Jesus Christ, the supernatural Son of God living inside of you. Now, I've got to be honest. It would be a tragedy if I got up here and all this message was an exercise in theory for me. But it's not. It's not. I'm almost dread to say this, but 40 years ago this week, I graduated from high school. I wished I could say I was a child prodigy and I graduated when I was 4, but I can't. You do the math. 40 years ago, I graduated from high school. And within a week or so, my friend and I, my best friend that I had grown up with, we went with his family on vacation. We had a blast. We had a great time. All clean fun. But I came back, and I could not believe the incredible emptiness that I had in my heart. And it just followed me wherever I was going. Just a little bit out of high school, had absolutely no idea what I was going to do with my life. Had no purpose, no direction, no understanding of any of that. But I knew exactly what I needed to do. And so on July 17th, 1976, I knelt by my bedside and I gave my life to Christ. That was a Saturday, I checked. The very next day, I went up to the pastor of the little church that I had grown up in and I told him the decision that I made. 40 years later, what would I possibly say about serving Jesus Christ this long? I could not find in my heart words that would fit better than the ones that have been used by Ravi Zacharias. This is my life right here. I came to him because I did not know which way to turn. I've remained with him because there is no other way I wish to turn. I came to him longing for something I did not have. I remained with him because I have something I will not trade. I came to him as a stranger. I remain with him in the most intimate of friendships. I came to him unsure about the future. I remained with him, certain about my destiny. Jesus Christ is the only way. And here's what I believe after serving him for 40 years. People who need Jesus will be drawn by people who want Jesus. That you and I would be the kind of people who say, I don't want anything else but to pursue Jesus. Would you say that that is your heart's desire? Because people who need Jesus will be drawn by people who want nothing else but Jesus. God knows your heart. God knows my heart. And he knows the desire of your heart to want nothing but Jesus. That is what he asks for. Because at the end of the day of all days, when we stand before God, there will be one standing, and it is the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's who I want. And maybe you've never come to the point where you have embraced Jesus. Maybe there's something that happened just a moment ago when four beautiful young people went through waters of baptism and fearlessly declared to everyone that all they want is Jesus. Now that's you. You've never come to a point where you've given your life to Christ. Right outside these doors, and same thing with the East Worship Center. It's a place called the Fireside Room. There are prayer partners there. There's pastors there. They would love to help you find the only path to God, and it's Jesus. I hope we have convinced you of just how wonderful Jesus is. You take his name with you, and have a wonderful day and a great week. Thank you. God bless you.